Hello there! Welcome to the International Business Podcast, a show for those who work across time zones, borders, and cultures. I'm your host, Leonardo, from Shanghai, but let's make it simple and just call me Leo. We also have a new co-host, Stefano, based in Paris. Coming up on today's episode.
Even if you move a plant, whether it's back to the US or to Mexico, your entire supply chain isn't moving at the same time you are. Lived there for 2 years and then ran the Asia Pacific office in Hong Kong. So my first 5 years out of college was all in China with all Chinese people, really. And so when I eventually moved back to the US, I had to learn how to be American.
Kimberly has over 30 years of international experience in multiple regions with a focus in Asia. A decade in operations, manufacturing and supply chain, a decade in accounting, and now the last 10 years as a consultant and interim executive. You can find more information about Kimberly in the show notes. Let's dive into today's episode. Hi, Kimberly. I'm glad to have you on. Welcome to the International Business Podcast.
Thank you, Leo. I'm happy you invited me.
So I invite international professionals, international business people every Monday. So why are you here, Kimberly? Why would you define yourself as an international business person?
You know, I grew up in a very small village in the Midwest of the United States. And I am the seventh generation of my family in this village, which in the US is kind of unusual, honestly. But I was a big reader. I read a lot of books and as a child. And so I really wanted to live the life of those books. I wanted to live around the world. And people thought that was a crazy idea, you know, for me, especially at that time. So when I went to university, I ended up studying international business and I was fluent in Spanish at the time. But I thought this is not going to get me a job. You know, it's not unique enough. So I took a class in Asian cultures. And Japan was big at the time. This is the mid 80s. And there's a lot of business developing between Japan and the United States. But this class I took on Asian cultures, the Japanese are not fans of women, you know, or foreigners. And I thought, yeah, I'm not doing this for the next 30 years. So the Chinese culture felt more like my small town Midwest, very, you know, long history, family dynamic, relationships. And I thought, I can do that, right? And there wasn't a lot of business between the US and China, so people thought it was a stupid idea. Of course, I have the last laugh now, right? So I think I was the first. Ohio State University has 60,000 students, and I think I was the first business major to ever take Chinese. So that's how I got started. And then they shipped me to China for a year. They had an exchange program. You couldn't just go to university in China. It had to be on scholarship of some kind. And it was very limited. So I went to Beijing Language, what's now Language and Culture University. At the time, it was Language Institute. And who gets a scholarship from the Chinese government? You know, so my roommate was Czech. And the Russians weren't allowed to stay with us. They had to be on their own. They couldn't be near us. But very few European Americans, maybe 10 in total, but a lot of other communist countries and socialist countries. And so we had a lot of Africa, South America. It was a mini United Nations, and it was great. And then I was hired by a US company to run their factories outside of Shanghai. Long story how that happened, but I ended up never set foot in a factory in my life, you know, and they said, we want you to go manage these. I'm like, sure, I'm down. I wanted to be in operations, you know, so it was exactly what I was looking for. I lived in Shanghai, and our factories were in a very small village in the countryside. And lived there for 2 years and then ran the Asia Pacific office in Hong Kong. So my first 5 years out of college was all in China with all Chinese people, really. And so when I eventually moved back to the US, I had to learn how to be American. Because when you get out of college, your brain is still developing, they now know, you know, at 21, 22, 23, 24, you're learning judgment and reason, but you're also practically learning how to be an adult. You know, in a way that you don't learn at university. And I learned how to be a Chinese adult. And so, you know, I learned how to negotiate from the guys that worked for me, but they were 10, 30 years older than I was. So I came back to the US. I landed in San Francisco and then with the same company moved to LA, and I had huge culture shock. And not just from that, but also economically. I lived in China when it was very undeveloped still. And so moving back and having cars and grocery stores, you know, I'd lived in Hong Kong for a year or two, but still it was just a huge shock. And so my whole life has really been China. I spent my 20s in manufacturing operations, supply chain. And then I moved back to this small village when I was having my children. I became a CPA and worked for a regional CPA firm, was CFO for a company. And that's really when early 2000 companies started calling me and saying, we hear you used to run factories in China. We're opening one. Could you help us? So I started my own consulting practice, and I've worked with probably over 1,000 companies over in 20 years. Big, you know, Disney, Lubrizol, Swagelok, American Greetings, Vitamix, Curtis Wright, different industries, chemical, consumer products, industrial machinery, all kinds of different things. Setting up their plants in China in the early years, negotiating with the government, site selection, building, hiring, setting up their operations. And then from 2010 on, it became more sales offices, setting up sales offices, distribution channels. And then the last 5 years, I call it oh shit. Oh shit moments of, we have a plant in China, you know, we don't understand why they're doing this. Because I'm not only do I have the, you know, the Chinese, little Chinese mindset inside of my brain still after you know, growing up there in a way. But also I'm technically Chinese labor law and VAT tax and how you get money out of China. And, you know, so I lecture a lot on these topics, and I help my clients with these. So, and I was fortunate to live in Europe a couple times. I have clients in Europe, you know, so I've really had, you know, a broad international background. I used to have factories in Thailand and Indonesia and Korea and all over the region, but my heart is Chinese. You know, really. And you, my generation of expats or foreigners, they typically went to Taiwan first, you know, or they went to Hong Kong first. And so they often went to China with the Taiwanese. You know, the Taiwanese were opening plants in China, the Hong Kong Chinese were opening plants in China. And so their attitude towards the PRC was colored by that experience. Because China wasn't as nice as Taiwan. It wasn't as developed. And the Taiwanese don't trust the Chinese and vice versa. So a lot of these foreigners are like, you can't trust the Chinese. They lie. And I'm like, look, let's get this on the table. I bleed PRC Chinese. Because my experience was China from the day one, Beijing, Shanghai, these small villages. You know, so my mindset was not Taiwan experience, and then you go to China and it's wrong. It was China experience first.
I love simple definitions of business terms, Kimberly. What is supply chain management?
Supply chain management is everything that it takes to get a product from the producer to the consumer.
So you've run hundreds of projects helping companies to improve their international operations. Let's focus on a second on the complexities of moving manufacturing across borders. What are these complexities?
Well, there's a lot of them, but it depends. There's two separate scenarios. One is you have your own factory and you're moving production from your own factory to your own factory. And the other is you're using third-party suppliers. Where companies first run in, they have the same problems with both in many ways, but one of the biggest issues with third-party suppliers is that a lot of times the purchaser has not gathered enough information about how their product's being made. So we call this a lack of portability. So they developed a product with a supplier in China. I just was on the phone with a New Zealand company about this last week. They've developed products with a supplier in China who's helped them iterate changes and improvements into their product so that their product is unique in the market. The problem is they don't know what those are. So if they now want to leave that supplier and go to another supplier, they don't have any idea on how to replicate making that product somewhere else. And in a similar fashion, even if you have your own factory, let's use moving a production from China to Mexico as an example. Even if you have your own factory in China or US to China in the first place, even in the US, companies don't document, their product documentation is horrible. They don't write down, because it relies on the fact that Joe has been doing this for 20 years and he knows how to do it in the plant. So when they try to move it to China or when they try to move it from China to Mexico, there's all these problems. So the first is product documentation. The second issue is really making a good decision about who is that new supplier or where are you relocating your plant to? What are the labor capabilities in that market? You know, and all of the things you need to do in qualifying a vendor or looking at what costing would be in a new location. Those are things that companies underestimate or don't spend enough time in. Logistics changes. You know, I was just interviewed for an article that came out over the weekend here in the US about Peloton, the bicycle exercise company. They're building a plant in Ohio. And, you know, the local news is saying, are they bringing their manufacturing back? And I'm like, no, they're not. They've still got their suppliers in China. They're actually building a plant in Taiwan and they're building a plant in Ohio. So yes, they're moving quote unquote production here, but in all likelihood, a lot of their raw materials and sub-suppliers are still going to be in China. Even if you move a plant, whether it's back to the US or to Mexico, your entire supply chain isn't moving at the same time you are. So you've really got to look at, does this mean I'm going to have increased inventories because I'm going to have to hold more raw materials? Is it going to increase my cost of raw materials because of freight? Are there customs fees or tariffs on the motor that's going into my machine or the steel that's going into this part? So you really need to look at the impact of your supply chain on just moving your final production, let's say. And then logistics, is it going to increase the freight time? Is it going, you know, obviously the cost, freight cost is going to be there on raw materials. And then skilled labor is an issue, you know, and that was one of my comments on the article this last week was the US doesn't have skilled labor for manufacturing anymore. And people on average don't want those jobs. They haven't wanted those jobs for 20 years. So clients of mine that have factories in China, in the US are constantly complaining. We can't find CNC machine operators. We can't find tooling, you know, tooling and die makers. We can't, you know, so even though you're, and this is when the tariffs first hit, companies were looking to move from China to Vietnam. Vietnam has a fairly low cost labor pool, but they're not skilled in the jobs that are there. The Vietnamese government decided 10 years ago or more that they were going to try to skip over the low cost labor jobs. They didn't want clothing and food and shoes and kind of the unskilled labor jobs. They wanted to go straight to high tech, you know, high manufacturing. The problem is their labor force isn't trained for that, you know, and again, that it's not the Chinese work ethic is the focus on work and working and making money and providing for your family. That isn't replicated in a lot of other, you know, growing, not yet industrialized markets. So you really need to look at not only is there labor and what the labor cost is, but is it skilled? Are they a willing workforce? Are they going to work overtime if I need it? Is there a lot of turnover? You know, you have to look more deeply before you look at moving.
I completely agree with what you've said. I'm no Chinese, but I have to say I changed job like a year ago and I still have to use at least one of my holidays. Just because when you're here in China, you get so much used to this, I will say, highly dynamic and fast-paced environment. Here you do work and then you get kind of acquainted with this environment. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, Kimberly. Anyway, I need to book some holidays. So After coordinating production and sourcing offices in, Korea, China, and Thailand, what are the common traits that you see across these countries in Asia?
Well, I think one of the biggest is failure avoidance, I call it. So in most Asian cultures, for a variety of reasons, some of them, the education style, relationship, the importance of community and relationship. So people don't want to fail. And it's not, Westerners can look at that like they don't want to make a mistake, or they're not confident enough to try and make a mistake. And it's not that. It's more about, I don't want to let you down. You know, you've entrusted me with whatever this is, whatever task you've given me. And that means you believe I can do it. And if you believe I can do it, then I need to do it. And if I can't, I've let you down. I've let myself down, but I've really let you down. So I think that's one of the, you know, the biggest commonalities. I'd say the other one is, you hear in the West all the time about, you know, the Chinese and you know, can't create. They're not creative people, which is not true. You know, it's not true. It's a different form of creativity. The West, and I think the US in particular, elevates what I call break it and build it creativity, destructive creativity. So I'm going to set up a company and I'm going to make a new, a better phone. I don't have to learn how other people make phones first. I can, because that's easy, right? I can just start making my own new phone. And so it's very much, it's in what Asian cultures, that's seen as just absolutely arrogant. How could you possibly think you could make a phone if you first couldn't make an iPhone? Like, first copy the iPhone, right? And after you can make a good iPhone, then you can have the audacity to think that you could actually make something better. But why, how dare you try to make something better if you first can't make that? You know, so there's saying in many countries, copying is the sincerest form of flattery. And that's very true in many Asian cultures for that reason. You don't want to fail. And creativity is based on iterative creativity. So I'm going to copy it first. And then once I've done that, once I know I can do it, then I'll make small iterations, small changes to improve it, rather than the break it and build it, you know, creativity model.
So you've recently helped in negotiating the sale of a US WFOE in China to a local party, winding down the operations, and we're talking about 120 employees. First of all, for maybe those listeners who don't know what WFOE is, please define that, and then tell us about this project as well.
Sure. A WFOE stands for Wholly Owned Foreign Entity. And basically in China, in many countries, the US, for example, I'm also a CPA. So you can choose between a C-Corp, you know, an LLC, different forms of corporations. In China, there's specific forms of corporations for foreigners. So there's a wholly owned foreign entity, a joint venture signifies that it's a joint venture between a local Chinese and a foreign company. You know, so there's different types of entities. So that's what a WFOE is. It means that it's wholly owned by foreign parties and there's no Chinese investment or owning of the business. So it's, yeah, that as far as the sale is concerned, it's very interesting. So this company has an old school manufacturing plant in Guangzhou, and it's nothing sexy or fancy. You know, it's tier one automotive parts, and it's been profitable, but not wildly so, right? So they were looking at getting out of it because they just wanted to consolidate. You know, the owners are getting, I hope they don't listen to this, the owners are getting a little older. And they're kind of looking to consolidate the business. They have a plant in Mexico, two plants in the US, this plant in China. So they thought, well, let's see if we can't sell it while we can. They found a broker who was able to sell it for the real estate value. So what's been interesting about it, I was referred to them from the US government commercial services office, who helps companies with this kind of thing. When it started to get stickier, they recommended me. And so the first part of it was negotiating the sale with the buyer. The broker's involved and there's lawyers involved. But the Americans, even though they've had this plant in China over 10 years, there were a lot of requests from the Chinese side of, we need these documents, or we have to prepare a joint venture contract for the wholesale, but then we need separate contracts for parts of the sale because they're going to different government entities. So a lot of times that, and then how the Americans were concerned, are we really going to get paid? How can we make sure we get paid? How do we get the money out? You know, so it was a lot of that in the beginning. And then once we got everything signed, it was terminating the workforce. Well, first we had to help the customers bulk up on their inventory so that they, because if in tier one automotive, for the customers to change to a different supplier, they have to, everything has to be tested and approved by the automotive companies. So, you know, it's nothing, you can't just turn off the customer faucet. So they took them about 9 months to of really heavy production to get enough inventory in their customers that they could start to wind down the plant. So when we started, we started laying people off early, because I said the smart thing to do is, once you get over a certain percentage, the per government, Chinese government law, you have to negotiate with the labor bureau and have a negotiated layoff settlement. So I said, we don't want to do that if we can. So let's start with 10 people here, 10 people next week. And we had the slowdown in business and the tariffs and other things to kind of, because you have to have a cause to terminate someone in China. It's very complicated to terminate people in China. I do a lot of consulting on this. You have to have, you have to have a contract. They have to have an employment contract, but you need a termination contract. And there are only so many reasons you're allowed to terminate, what's called with cause, without cause, and then illegal termination is the other term. So we started this with 10 employees and then, you know, another 10 employees. And the Americans were shocked at how much negotiation was involved, you know, because again, in the U.S. is what's called an at-will employment country. So I can terminate anybody at any point just because I want to. So this whole idea that they had to agree to be terminated and that we had to negotiate how much severance they were going to get, you know, so that was just, and they kept saying to me, we're going to have to do this with all 120 people, like pretty much, you know, so, and, but in the beginning, what's critical in the beginning is you want to set the standard that, that you're not going to give in. So you have to give a fair, somewhat generous package, a little bit more than what the government asks for, but you have to stay firm with that, because if you don't, then the next 100 people are going to know what you did in the first 20. You also have to be, you know, loop in the labor bureau, even though this wasn't necessarily managed layoffs in the beginning, because they need to feel that you're going about this the right way, that you respect them, you respect their authority. So we did that. We had somebody go in and meet with the labor bureau and lay out, you know, what we're doing, a little bit here, a little bit there. They asked us to delay for the October 1st holidays because they didn't want their numbers to go down before the holidays. And the Americans had a fit. It's been 2 months of negotiating all this stuff. We need to get rid of these people. We need to be done with it. What the heck? I said to them, look, we're doing the Labor Bureau a favor to give them, you know, to delay it until after the October 1st holidays. So after that, they'll do us a favor, right? If a couple employees come in and start complaining, they're going to brush them off a little bit. You know, this is how these things work. So we're now down to just a very small number of people. The other problem that came up towards the end was they had so much sales that they built up a lot of cash. And that cash, there's different ways to get that cash out. We could ask the buyer to increase the purchase price. We can pay the US for engineering support for the last year with, you know, winding down the plant. We could pay some expenses that the US has in China because they buy from some other suppliers in China and have an intercompany. So this project is a great one for me because I, like I said, I spent my 20s, you know, in manufacturing and operations, and then I became a CPA. So this is a lot of intersection of supply chain operations, import, export, and then the labor law, moving money, all those kind of things.
So you talked about the US and China. It is impossible to talk about international business without naming these two countries. So looking at the next 5 years, Kimberly, how is the relationship between the US and China going to transform?
You know, I think it's interesting. I was at a lecture a number of years ago, and they were talking about, and I'm not sure I pronounced this properly, but the Thucydides principle, which is that as a rising power starts to eclipse the current power, there's inevitably war. And that hasn't happened since, you know, the common understanding is that hasn't happened since the advent of nuclear weapons, because people don't want to go there. My argument is it's happening, but it's no longer a war in the sense that we think of war. It's a technology resource war. Who has the best technology? Who has access to the most resources? Who is the most influential in technology? So I think we are, in a way, in a war. And you see the US trying to shut down Huawei and not allow WeChat to be downloaded in the US. You see different, you know, governments trying to stop China's impact in the world. And China, of course, understandably is saying, what the heck, you know, and again, one of the things I find, whether it's with individuals or with countries, you know, or people, is we assign our motives to someone else's behavior. So when the US goes to Africa, Western countries think they're colonialists. They want to go run that country. They want to influence their politics, because that's what Britain did. You know, in Portugal and France and Italy and England, you know, and the US to a great extent, you know, has done that. So we think China's going to do that. China doesn't care. They've always been, I call them a navel gazer. You know, they're looking at their own belly button. They like their own food. They like their own culture. They like their own people. It's fun to go overseas and visit other countries, but they really want to eat Chinese food. And they really want to be home at the end of the day. So they're not interested in running other countries. They're not interested in colonizing other countries. They're a resource poor country, and they've been a resource poor country for decades. They've been a net importer of food. They don't have enough, you know, timber or lumber or paper. They don't have enough energy sources. So for China, it's about resource acquisition and continuity, but it's not about running or colonizing another country. So the US is every country falls. Every power eventually falls. I mean, it's going to happen, right? So it's not in, and when it's happening to you, of course, you're not enjoying it. But China is the new superpower, and that is what it is. And Americans also link democracy to industrialization. So as countries industrialize, they're thereby going to become democracies. Well, that's not true. You know, democracy is and we could talk about all this for hours, but democracy is an unnatural state for humans. Humans across centuries have been run by some form of, you know, autocracy. There's always been a strong leader, whether it's a monarchy or, you know, a dictator. There's always been, people like in some ways to be told what to do. They like certainty. And democracies can be very uncertain, which we've seen in the US and the UK and some other countries in the last 10 and 20 years. There can be a tremendous amount of uncertainty and too much volatility. And so people tend to organize themselves in much more dictatorial government societies, typically. So it would be interesting if I was alive 100 years from now to see how long democracies last and how they evolve, if they evolve. And I don't know. So I think the US is really struggling with losing that supremacy. And they're casting China. And then politically, you know, this has been true also for thousands of years. The easiest way to rally people to your side is a common enemy. So Trump used that, you know, a lot of American presidents have used China, Russia before China, and then China as the enemy to rally Americans. So it's very fraught. Now, I don't think we're going to a man-to-man war. I would hope the U.S. would eventually recognize China's right to exist on their own terms and not try to keep forcing them to be the form of government and the type of world leader we want them to be. You know, they get to be the type of world leader they want to be. You know, so I don't know. It's not gonna calm down anytime soon, but I hope it does not escalate.
You made me smile because in my previous job, I was the only foreigner in a 300 people company, all Chinese. And we were traveling every month around the world, attending medical exhibitions. And of course, it was me and my Chinese teammates. I tried every single Chinese restaurant in Germany, Australia, the US, Sweden, and so on and so forth. Absolutely true.
Horrible. Horrible, isn't it? The only advantage we have now is there have been so many Chinese students in the US in the last 5 or 10 years that I think that probably at least 4 or 5 in any major city have said to mom and dad, there's shit to eat here. Send me a couple $1 million. I want to open a restaurant. You know, so now you can find some decent Chinese restaurants near big universities that have good Chinese student populations. But yeah, I miss the food so much. You have no idea. It's been so long since I've been in China. I miss it just kills me if I think about it. You know, I hate it.
I've got one final question, Kimberly, that I ask everyone who comes on the show, and I'm sure you do have many of these episodes, but I would like you to choose one. Tell us about one memorable moment from your international career that could be, I don't know, funny, a catastrophic, or even a successful episode.
Sure. I was thinking about that earlier. And one of the stories that I tell people on negotiation in China, I was working with a company that made hand tools. And so they had a supplier in China and they were trying to get the supplier to do an extra production step. They wanted them to anneal is the technical term. They wanted them to anneal the product, which would harden it. And so the Americans kept asking, they had an agent who was working with the factory because the factory didn't have any English speakers and they couldn't export. So they kept asking the agent, please tell the factory we want them to do this annealing. And the factory was like, nah, I don't think so. So the supply chain manager and I were visiting the factory in Jiangsu province, somewhere, Changsha or somewhere, Changshu. So we're at the factory. And again, the American, we're sitting, you know, the table, big conference table. And we're sitting across from the agent and the factory manager and a couple engineers. And the American said, and I let them know I speak Chinese at the beginning, you know, just because I think it's only fair. Right. So it's always a little bit of, you know, so it's just a little bit of Chinese so that they understand that I understand. Right. The American says to the agent, we want them to do this annealing. And the agent translates. And then the Chinese manager turns to his team and he's like, what the hell's wrong with these people? Are they stupid? We're one of the number one factories in the country. Our tools are hard enough. We have two other major clients in the US. They don't require us to anneal these tools. Why are these guys asking for it? They clearly don't know what the hell they're doing, idiots. So then the agent has to translate that back to the American, right? So the agent looks at the American and says, they'll think about it. So lesson number one is the agent's doesn't want to insult you. Doesn't want to blow up the relationship. It's not that he's trying to lie, right? So we get up and go to lunch. We go tour the factory. We come back in the afternoon and sit down. Now, the typical American way to manage this would be to say, I'm the customer, damn it. And I want you to anneal it. I'm willing to pay for it. You should just do it because I want you to. What's the problem? You know, but that's not what I did. I told the American guy, I said, let me handle this, right? So I looked at the Chinese manager and I said, you know what? I totally understand where you're coming from. And I couldn't agree more. I said, but here's our problem. I said, you know how the government is. I said, we have an opportunity to sell to the US military and the US government. And you know how they are. They have these stupid rules and expectations that don't make any sense whatsoever. But if you want to sell to the military and the government, you have to follow their rules. You can't argue with them. They require the product to be annealed. Even our engineers don't think it's necessary. But you know, if we sell to the military, that makes us the number one brand. Now, that was a lie. In the U.S., selling to the military or the government at your average product doesn't make you the number one brand, right? Like it does, but it's very true in China. It's very true in China. So, you know, basically I'm giving them something that fits within their view, within their perspective, a reason that they can understand. So he looked at me and he said, absolutely no problem, we'll do it. So it wasn't about, you know, the American thought they had to either bully them or they had to pay more money or teach them how to do it. It's not that. It's that, and it's crazy. I had another recent client that was, he wanted someone in China to call a factory and ask about buying their product. And I said, it's not that easy. You'd think you could just call and they'd be happy to have a new customer. And instead they're like, who are you? How did you hear about us? Where are you coming from? You know, how are you going to sell our product? So, you know, it's again, very relationship driven and reputation driven. And so we solved the problem. It was great. Worked out. So that's one of my favorite stories.
So I would like to wrap this up by asking you, who should connect with you after listening to this episode? And tell us a little bit more about your current position.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for having me today. It was great. Great to be here with you. So my consulting practice is international operations, and we do a lot of work with companies that already have, I don't typically work with beginners. Beginners don't know what they don't know. Most of my clients are companies that are already knee deep in China. And I've recently become an advisor for New Zealand, New Zealand government, New Zealand Trade and Enterprise. I'm advising New Zealand companies on international trade coming into the US, import, export, moving money. And then sometimes they have suppliers and factories in China and they're looking at putting a plant in the US. So really cross-border moving goods or businesses across borders, money, moving money across borders, employment, tax law issues. that's a lot of what I do. I also really look forward to, I love working with students. So anyone at a university or classes, I love to lecture to students in universities and for international trade organizations. I do a lot of teaching for international trade organizations, for companies and executives on supply chain or import-export, various topics. I'm teaching at a university next month on e-commerce and social media marketing international. And I love helping people. So if someone is starting up a business, if they're looking at making a career move, and they want some advice, the best way to get a hold of me is LinkedIn, which I'm sure you'll connect, you know, and put on. I use LinkedIn. It's my only social media really is LinkedIn. But I love to help the next generation of people or people that are starting their own companies or stuck with a problem, you know, with the company that they have now or changing careers. So anyone like that, that I can help, I'd love to talk to.
I've never done that, but I want to ask one more question. I would like you to answer in one or two sentences. One piece of advice that you will give to university students right now.
It's not about the degree that you get or the industry that you work in. You need to understand how you want to live every day. Do you like to be around people? Do you like a lot of interaction? Do you like to have one project that you start and work on it until you finish it? Knowing that about yourself will lead you to the right job and to happiness more than choosing the food industry over garments or mechanical engineering over a business degree. In any of those areas, you can find happiness if you understand how you want to work, how you like to live your life every day.
Kimberly, I want to thank you for your insights. Thank you for joining us on the International Business Podcast.
Thank you, Leo, and to everyone who listens.
Subscribe today to listen to more international business stories. We have new guests every Monday. Connect with us on LinkedIn, info in the show notes. See you next week. Cheers.